did you think your chances of making the Yankees were? I know that DiMaggio and Henrik had left for the service then, but what did you think your chances were?
Well, I thought they were pretty good simply because I had some good years in the minor leagues. And they wanted me to hit second, and in the second slot was the fast man in front of me like Sternweiss, and I could pull, and I didn't strike out. I only struck out about 30 times a year, and then I hit a few home runs. So it enhanced it in that sense, and I thought that I had a very good chance.
We talked a few years ago, and you told me that you were essentially, I don't remember if you said a spray hitter or a wrong field hitter, but you told me that when you came up to the Yankees, Joe McCarthy asked you to pull.
Yeah, what they did to me was they opened me up because they wanted me to pull more. In the second slot, with like having speed in front of me, they wanted that man on third, if possible. And so they opened me up so I'd pull more. And also the favor of the right field fence in the stadium. It was 1944, I believe it was. I led the American League in home runs up until August. And then Rudy Yark hit 18 in the month of August.
That's interesting.
So that's one reason why they did. And for a left-hand hitter to be hitting to the opposite field with a man on first, not very conducive of advancing the runners.
Mm-hmm. I see. You played right field, am I correct?
Yes.
Keller was in left in 43 and Lindell in center.
That's correct.
What was it like to play right field in the Yankee Stadium? I know it wasn't the Sun Field, but you had a short
No,
there.
It was... the one thing you had to get used to was the contour of the fence, whether it was on the ground or whether it was a fly ball. You had to know about where you were all the time. You see, back then we didn't have warning tracks. So it made it a little more difficult. But then we went on the road, Detroit, and Boston, and places like that, and St. Louis, all of them were sunfields. Only time I didn't get one was in New York. So half of the time I didn't have that sunfield.
Do you consider the 1943 Yankees the best club you ever played for? They were pennant winners, World Series winners.
Well, naturally, I do. But when I was in the minor leagues at Kansas City, that's when Newark and Kansas City were the top minor league teams in the country. And on that team, we had seven fellas playing every day, hit over 300, and we had a big league pitching staff. And so people used to say that we could have finished in first division in the big leagues. So to compare teams, naturally, the one in New York would have to be better simply because we had men like a catching staff of Dickey and Hemsley. And we had fellows like Etten and Gordon and Sternweiss and Johnson, and they hit that ball. Plus we had some Hall of Famers like Ruffing and a few. Broy, he wasn't a Hall of Famer, but...
But a good pitcher.
Well, a pitcher.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to the 1943 World Series. A lot's been said about the second game. Mort Cooper won it, and mm-hmm. Ian Walker had learned just before the game that their dad had died.
Yeah.
Did the Yankee ball players know this before the game? What was their reaction?
I can't recall whether they knew it or not before that, or that it got to us at all. But I can tell you one thing. I was in Wright, and... Sanders hit a ball out there, and I hit the fence running it. And if anybody but myself had been playing right field, they would have caught it because all the outfielders were taller than I am. It hit my glove and went in the stands for a home run, and that's the only game we lost.
That's right.
Only game, and so I just feel that if one of the other outfielders had been there, they would have caught the ball simply because of height.
That's very interesting. Later on in the series, Marius Russo, who had a sore arm by that time, still had enough. I think he eked out a 2-1 victory. Any special memories of that game or Mr. Russo?
Well, Marius was just a fine money athlete. You know, he was an All-American basketball player at LIU.
Oh, really?
Yes, and He was just a good pitcher. He was a left-hander. He'd get the ball over and get it down. And that's a wonderful asset. And being the competitor that Marius was, he's the man you had to count on.
So you were you're telling me then that when the chips were down, he was at his best.
That's right. He sure
Nobody
was.
A money pitcher.
He really was.
Now, in the final game, Bill Dickey hit a two-run homer off Mort Cooper, I believe, and that was that was it, a 2-0 game. And then Dickey went into service. What do you remember about Dickey or about that particular game?
Well, Dickey was just a great hitter. You know, one day I was sitting on the bench and we were chewing the fat. And I said, Bill, in your mind, what's it take to be a 300 hitter in the big leagues? He said, you have to hit 4 balls on the nose every day, whether you get them or not. And then the reason it is so vivid still in my memory is that that day he hit 5 balls and didn't get a one of them. I mean, he hit them well. The next day, he hit 4 on the nose, and he got 3 of them. Now, that's 3 for 9.
There's your 3 numbers.
Yeah, and I've never forgotten that. And there's a lot of truth in it. Now, you're going to get your blooper here and there to make up for those hard shots, see? Mm-hmm. But you still have to make that kind of contact all the time. And Bill was just a great catcher, great catcher.
Why do you say that?
Well, he was so stable. It's almost impossible to get the ball by him for pass balls. And he did such a fine job of handling the pitchers. And he was a leader. He was a leader.
Was he a holler guy out there?
No,
the
sir.
Field general? Or?
You know, at New York, we didn't have really holler guys on the club.
Hmm.
If you look back over the years, New York didn't have that real holler guy all the time. Now, they had some bench jockeys, but they worked with the philosophy that if I make less mistakes than you, I'm going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their philosophy. And when you walked between those lines, it was all business. Wasn't any place for mental errors.
Mm-hmm.
And if you made a mental error, as soon as you hit the dugout, McCarthy lets you know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the almost 5 years I was there, I was, you know, just lacked a couple months of being there. Well, I missed 2 signs.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I came to the dugout, he said to me, he said, buddy, he says, come here. He said, do you know your signs? I said, yes, sir. And he said, bull blank. To me. And that's the way he balled me out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he knew people. And he knew how much he had to say or how much he didn't have to say.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of his main assets with McCarthy. He knew how to handle personnel. Well, look at all the great stars he had in the past. He better know how,
mm-hmm.
and he did. But he was a very, very intelligent man.
So I was going to ask you what you thought of him as a manager.
Well, if you want to talk about Shakespeare, he talked about Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was well-read.
Well-educated.
Well-educated, mm-hmm. Yes, sir. He was a real student of the game of baseball, too. And he kept you on your toes all the time. For instance, if you weren't in a ball game that day, he'd be somewhere along. He'd ask you a question about that game
to keep you winning.
That's right. Wanted to see if you were staying in the game and not just staying there sitting on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
You were getting paid for sitting on the bench as well as if you were in there playing. And he was the type of person that. He never made a rule. But the rules were passed down by the veterans to the rookies. That's how you learn the rules. And you better adhere to them. It was a tradition. It was a pride.
Mm-hmm.
New York had pride. And I always remember...
So the veterans were not at odds with him. They fell into step with what he wanted.
That's right. And Crosetti taught Rizzuto to take his job. Now that's a switch, isn't it?
Sure is.
And you know how many years the Crow was up there even after? He was up there, what, 22 years?
Through the war.
Yeah, all those years, before and after. And so Even way back in, when I came out of William & Mary, I'd always heard that to learn how to win, they teach you to win. And it wasn't that way. It was a different approach. They taught you how not to lose. Hmm. In that manner, you were winning, but they taught you not to make those mistakes. And all the way up through the line, it was all business.
So you would say then that the Yankees were not arrogant winners?
No, sir. I mean, they had pride. And I'll give you another example. When we traded for an athlete from another team and they come in, mm-hmm. almost invariably, the first thing they would say, man, am I glad to be here.
The word had gotten around.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It was built by the teams way back in the 20s and the 30s, you know. Mm-hmm. That prestige and pride, that was built by those people. And the ones coming on, they didn't want to be responsible for that pride not being there.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go around the infield of the 43 club and have you comment a little on each of the players. First base, Nick Hedden.
Nick, well, you know, he was a leading RBI hitter in the league.
Home runs.
And he did a remarkable job for us for a big, couldn't run, but he did a real fine job, and he was a tremendous asset, had a lot of fortitude. He was a tremendous guy.
Joe Gordon at second.
Joe was an acrobat. I've never seen anybody get in so many different positions and then still get something on the ball. He made errors on balls that other people would never get to. And I played right field behind him, so I know.
You saw him in action.
Yes, sir. He was a fine, fine fielder, and he had a lot of power.
How would you compare him and Bobby Doerr, perhaps the two best in the American League?
Bobby was a better percentage hitter than Joe. Joe was a different type hitter. He was a power hitter, and he hit a lot of home runs. Mm-hmm. I'd have to take Joe as a fielder. I really would. Not because he played greater range. Greater range, yes. He was an acrobat. He really was. And he just was all over the place.
Frankie Grossetti at short?
Well, Frank is probably the smartest baseball player I've ever known. He was not only a great athlete, he wasn't a great hitter, but he knew how to handle that bat and get the most out of it. But when it came to fielding and intelligence, Frankie was ahead of everybody. I was sitting on a bench one day, and Frank hollers, "Time." And McCarthy said on the base, he said, "Now what in the world is that Daigle found out?" He was the first one to always catch something. He was that alert. He was a fine baseball man.
Billy Johnson, the third, a rookie that year.
Well,
a good one.
Billy was a good curveball hitter. And he had an excellent arm. And had good hands. And he did a tremendous job for us because he was a good curveball hitter and he made contact.
That's right. How was he?
Now, Ray White here in Norfolk, who is a manager here in Norfolk, and who is my pitching coach, he changed him from an outfielder to a third baseman. And then he sent him to Augusta, Georgia. That's where he first played third base.
Mm-hmm. How was he in the field?
He was a fine fielder. He really was. He did a good job. Now, he wasn't the agile fielder like Robinson or Nettles, that crew. He wasn't that agile. Mm-hmm. But he did a fine job. He had an adequate. But he really did the job with his bat.
Left field, Charlie Keller.
Old King Kong. Well, I'll tell you, Charlie was fast. He didn't look like it. But when you got in a race with him, he was always 1-2. Mm-hmm. And they used to have a lot of races back in the minor leagues and that. And Charlie won most of them, and with the different teams. Now, Charlie was just one tremendous hitter. Mm-hmm. And what power. I saw him hit a ball in the stadium one day, and it was just about 3 feet from the facade on the roof hanging over the bullpen. Just think, if it had been just 3 feet more towards center field, it would have been the first, probably only ball ever hit out of Yankee Stadium. And I mean,
he really did.
And it wasn't a looper coming down. It was still had plenty of power on it. Yeah, and he came back and he was mad because he didn't hit it harder. That's the kind of competitor he was. He was a great, great competitor.
I have shaken his hand. I met him. He was one of my interviews, and my hand felt like it was in a vice.
That's exactly. Tremendously strong.
Yeah, a tremendously strong man.
Yeah. And I'm just as nice a man as he was. And you never saw him really mad. The only time he got mad is when he was at the plate, and that's when he was supposed to get mad. Mm-hmm. He used to get mad at that plate. Boy, he was a tough hitter.
How was he in the field?
Fine. I mean, because he had that speed and he had a good arm. See, and he wasn't a flashy fielder. But you didn't have to worry about having an above adequate job done. He was a good one. This is one thing. You notice, the New York teams back then, they didn't give runs away. You earned everything you got. And that was one of their marks, and one reason they won. They didn't give you any runs. You had to earn them. And our pitchers were noted for getting the daggone ball over. Because walks kill you.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Lindell, center field?
John was a pitcher at one time. But he could swing that bat so well, and he had great speed for a big man. He covered a lot of ground, and he had that good arm from pitching. And plus, he's just had a great deal of power, too. And so John just fit like a glove in center field with that speed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, John and Keller were faster than I was. But I ran pretty well, but not as well as they did. So, and but they it was a very adequate outfield. Like, for myself, I had 17 assists. Which tied for the American League lead for assists from the outfield. So we.
You obviously had a strong arm.
Yeah, I had a good arm.
Right. Yeah.
I had a good arm.
Yeah. That's true.
But then I had the opportunity later to play with DiMaggio, you know, and oh, what a pleasure.
I can imagine.
Ah, man. What a ball player Joe is, or was. And, but, you know, you can't complain about as. From when I first started baseball in the Yankee chain until I finished, you can't complain about the athlete. Can't complain. You know, every club probably has one or two, what kind of boys you want to call them, but when they walk between that line, watch out. They was all business. It's a beautiful thing about the Yankees. We used to come out 10 o'clock in the morning, some of us, and it was and we used to enjoy it. And I'll never forget, DiMaggio had been in the service, and he was at Fort Mondo, and Frank Fossetti and I were sitting in the clubhouse one morning about 10 o'clock, and in walks Joe, and Joe sat down alongside me. He said, "Would you? How'd you feel about throwing a few to me?" I said, "I'd welcome it, Joe." So we went out. Now, Joe hadn't picked up a bat in 2 years. Of the first 15 I threw him, he hit 8 of them in the stands.
Wow.
Not picking up a bat in over 2 years.
That's
so. So it's just that a natural ability.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just a real guy. Wow. Me talking, I'm very proud of it. I was just an average athlete. The play we get the chance to play, you know, against that, with that type of athlete, and against the great athletes that I had a chance to play against, like, well, it was Williams, and Bridges, and Trucks, and Newhouser, and Bill Lee, you can rattle them all. I just lost them.
Sure.
But they were, it was a wonderful experience for me, and one that I cherish. And baseball has gave me the beginning of everything that I have, and that's what, like my job here, or the living,
friendship. Mm-hmm.
Sure. But the great big thing is you had the opportunity to to play with people of great ability. Mm-hmm. Take Tommy Byrne, great left hand. A doggone good hitter, too, as a pitcher. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, he could hit. And
How about Spud Chandler?
Spud,
he was the leader of the one of the, 43.
That's right, he was the most valuable player in the league. And he was a great, great competitor. You know, he was an All-American football player at Georgia. And he was a very determined man. And the greater challenge you gave him, the tougher he got. And I've heard him say many times, somebody got a hit off him. He said, "Won't happen again." You know, and that's something I always remember that I've learned that I try to pass on to my athletes is that you never heard the Yankees say, any one of them make a mistake or anything, say, "My fault." They never said it. They said, "It won't happen again." And it's a lot different approach. And that's the kind of determination they had. You'll never get that opportunity again. But not because of me. And so that's the way Spud was.
What was his repertoire of pitches?
He had about 6 pitches. And he had a good curveball. Well, he had good speed, good velocity. And he threw a slider. And then he threw a short screwball. And
Tony mentioned that he could throw it both ways.
That's right. He
both
sure
ways.
Did.
He could make it go up and in or down and away.
Right. And if you let him get a hold of a rough ball, now he did give you trouble, because he knew how to handle a rough spot on a ball, and he could make it do a little bit more. And all of them up there do. And but Spud wasn't a spitball; he never wet the ball. But if he got a hold of one that was rough, he could do the same thing with it.
Sure.
See. And so everybody's always hollering about keeping that new ball in there. But he was an excellent competitor. And in the World Series, the opening game, there was 69,965, or 69, something like that, in the Yankee Stadium. And that was the first 3 games. And but before that first game, Spud went warmed up. And we were sitting next to each other on the game, and well, it's for myself. I was a rookie in a World Series, and I thought everything was going to crush me, that pressure. And Spud, with all of these years of experience and being a veteran, his hands were, he couldn't hold them still. And when he walked out on that mound, he threw that first pitch, he was perfectly composed. That's the kind of mental and muscular control and conditioning he had of himself. He could come up to the moment. McCarthy, that's reading the pitch game opening day. Great competitor.
Atlee Donald, at one time he had great speed. I think by that time he had a sore arm.
That's right.
He
was faster than Feller, 4 miles an hour faster than Feller. And, you know, when he came up as a rookie, he won 16 straight. And I think that's still a record. I'm not sure.
No.
It isn't?
I think it was 13 straight, but you think he went up something like 19 wins, 3
was that it?
1939.
Yeah, and he could throw. But Atlee was another great competitor. He had a good screwball. No curve. He'd throw that ball and it'd fall off. He'd throw it something like a fart ball and it'd fall off. And it wasn't exactly a screwball, but it acted like a screwball. He'd make it fall off. But he had tremendous speed. And he didn't mind coming underneath your chin either. See, back in those days, that was part of the game.
Right.
Knock the hitters down. And we didn't have helmets.
Right.
And
what does ball do? I'm sure it was very live.
Very live.
Up and in, or
well,
see,
he got so he could finger the ball, and he could make that fastball rise or go sail in either direction.
Oh.
And then he'd had that fork ball that looked like it looked something like a knuckleball, or something like a screwball, and it'd fall off for him. And that compensated for his curve. See, when he threw his curve, he never let you hit it. He just let you look at it. Oh, yeah, he just let you look at it. Just to give you something else. he was working towards another pitch. See, no, he was. That's the kind of guys that were. They were just great competitors, great pitchers.
Tiny Bottom.
Oh,
he was
Lord.
Called tiny, but he was physically big.
6'5", 230, and could throw aspirin. And he had a fork ball, a true fork ball, and then later he added a knuckleball to it. Had no curve, but he could put the ball in a tin cup. He with as fast as he was a control pitcher. And when he made a mistake, it didn't make any difference because his ball was alive and he didn't hurt him. But I remember one year in the American Association, he led the league in ERA, won 13 and lost 12. And yeah, so it's that kind of tough luck. Or when he pitched for us in New York before he contacted cancer, when he walked on the mound, we never got any runs. We couldn't catch any runs for him. We'd get 2, 3, something like that. You know, we were noted for getting runs. Broy walked out there, we'd get 9,000 runs. It's just, I don't know why it was, but we always got Broy a lot of runs, and we couldn't score for Bonham.
Tell me about Broy.
Broy, he had good stuff, but he used to throw... different from others. He used to throw with more of a sling of his arm. Mm-hmm. And I never will forget the year, 1944, he had won, I think, 11 games for us. And unbeknown of Joe McCarthy, McPhail sold him to Chicago. 45 was it?
Mystery waiver deal.
That's what it was. And he went there and won 10 games, and we lost the pennant by 2.5 games. Mm. And that was the difference in us winning the pennant that year.
What do you know about the waiver deal? Why was he let go? Now, the Yankees got $90,000 for him. Did McPhail need cash at that time?
Yes. Oh, I don't know whether he needed cash, but you know, he got out of baseball after that. McPhail got out. And I feel that McPhail was trying to get as much money out of the game before he left.
Because I heard that Baroy sometimes tired in the late innings, but you just don't...
He didn't tire for us.
No.
Mm. Okay. He won 21 games that year. Somewhere along the line, he didn't tire.
So something didn't jive there. I mean, why, you don't let a guy who's won 11 by midseason go.
Well, McCarthy didn't know it until he read it in the paper the next day.
Oh, really?
That's,
Was he steaming?
It's the maddest I've ever seen. He did not know that deal was going on.
Hmm. Jimmy Dykes told me that he'd look at the waiver list and see Roy's name and figure, well,